Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. So much has been happening in courts around the country concerning voter ID that we thought it would be good to do a show to take a look at what's been happening in many states. Five courts in five states have ruled against voter ID and proof of citizenship laws. And there was a change in a ruling that took place in Wisconsin, and we'll talk about that as well. So, North Carolina, July 29, three-judge panel of the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals overturned the state's voter ID law. The North Carolina legislature requested data on the use by race of a number of voting practices, and then with this data enacted legislation that the court said restricted voting and registration in five different ways, all of which disproportionately affected African Americans. They said that they targeted African Americans with almost surgical precision. In Wisconsin, voter ID, of course, passed in 2011, and we've had a change here because this just happened a couple days ago. A federal appeals court panel ruled that stayed a partial injunction on the Wisconsin voter ID law, which required the state to allow citizens who have difficulty obtaining a photo ID to vote after signing an affidavit. This now means that the affidavit option is not available to voters in Wisconsin. But there is another ruling, and this all gets confusing because you don't know if these are going to be overturned or not, and can they be overturned before the election. The other ruling made it easier for voters to obtain a free ID, but there was also changes to voter-friendly changes, they're called, in the residency requirement, absentee balloting, restrictions affecting college students, and early voting. So we'll talk about Wisconsin. Kansas also had a ruling. North Dakota, a federal judge blocked the law requiring photo ID to vote, saying it unfairly burdens Native Americans in the state. So in the past few weeks, we've seen a lot of action in the courts. Will we see more action? And what does all of this mean? We'll have two guests with us to talk about all of the states. Mark Gaber is here. Mark practices election law and redistricting, as well as the First Amendment. He has an active pro bono practice, in particular related to LGBT rights. He is part of the legal team that succeeded in overturning Virginia's marriage ban. He's a 2004 Harry Truman Scholar representing the state of Wisconsin, and he has been involved in mentoring new Truman Scholars on issues of law and public policy. Mark, thank you very much for joining us. Hi.
Thank you, Kathleen. Hi.
Hi.
Glad to be on.
Yeah, good to have you here. Professor Michael McDonald is also with us, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Florida. His research interests are election and methodology. He's testified as an expert witness in voting rights cases. And we thank you very much, Professor McDonald, for joining us. Hi.
Hey, great to be with you. And just for full disclosure, I was an expert for the plaintiffs in the Kansas litigation that we're going to be talking about.
Oh, good. All right. Well, we'll write down Kansas and make sure we talk about that in some detail. Let me ask you, let's start with you, Professor McDonald. Why are we seeing all of these court cases right now? It's a number of them.
Well, this is the season for it. We had a number of laws that have been changed since the demise of Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, although technically, Section 5 is still active. What really went away was the formula which decided which states were going to be covered by Section 5. And that was a decision that was made called Shelby County versus Holder. And that opened the floodgates for a number of states to adopt more restrictive identification laws and other changes to their election systems. Now, not all of the states are of that caliber. Obviously, Wisconsin was not covered by Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, but some of the other states have moved almost immediately after the ruling to initiate a number of changes to their laws that were more restrictive in the way in which people would vote, and litigants have come in and challenged those laws, and so now we're starting to see the consequences of all of that litigation right here before the 2016 election, and it's important that we get this right and get it done now because the window's rapidly closing on when election officials can actually implement those changes before the election takes place. Mm-hmm.
We have some confusion here in Wisconsin. We'll get to Wisconsin in a moment. North Carolina was getting a lot of attention, Mark, and this is interesting that the North Carolina legislature did look at data on the use by race of a number of voting practices and then designed legislation based on that. Is that right?
That's what the Fourth Circuit found, and notably did so mere days after the Shelby County decision came down, and that's one of the reasons that the court cited in finding that these five changes were animated by discriminatory intent, which is a pretty rare finding for a court to make, that the legislature intended, acted with the intent to discriminate against a racial minority. And as you mentioned, the court highlighted throughout its opinion that for each of these changes, the legislature asked for and received data about how minorities versus white voters used these mechanisms, and as the court said, the surgical precision targeted the mechanisms used by African Americans. So, for example, with respect to requiring voter ID for in-person versus for absentee voting, the legislature learned that absentee voters were generally white voters, and in-person voters were disproportionately African-American, and so required that IDs be used in in-person voting, but not for absentee balloting.
Hmm. So the North Carolina decision will probably stand for the November elections, is that right?
Well, the state of North Carolina has indicated that it's going to seek emergency relief from the Supreme Court. Whether they will get that is, I think, more up in the air than it might have been before this point because, as everyone knows, the Supreme Court is now deadlocked in a 4-4 situation, and five votes would be needed to stay that mandate.
Let's go to Wisconsin. Whoever wants to take this first is fine. A federal appeals court just a couple days ago stayed a partial injunction on the voter ID law. Those who have had difficulty in getting the photo ID were going to be able to sign an affidavit, but then the appeals court said that they didn't specify how hard it was that group of people to get IDs, that it applied to too many people instead of those who were just having a hard time here. It's my understanding that the other ruling, unless this one is being appealed to and the same federal appeals court will hear the other areas that had to do with residency requirements and how long a polling place could be off, open, weekend registration, that kind of thing. It gets a little bit complicated and probably very confusing for voters, Professor McDonald.
Well, absolutely. And that decision from that appeals court can itself be appealed. So there are two ways in which that could be appealed. One could be what's called an en banc panel for the entire circuit, and the other is to appeal it all the way to the Supreme Court. Some people believe that the en banc panel actually has a majority that would uphold the lower court's decision and would reverse the district court, the appeals court's decision. So it's possible here that we could still see that appeals court, the three judges there, their decision reversed. And we could see that re-establishment of the affidavit. And what's interesting about this, though, is that in North Carolina and in Texas, the courts essentially forced the states to soften their voter identification laws to allow this affidavit option. In the before Shelby County was mooted, the Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, South Carolina had passed a voter ID law, and under Section 5 litigation, the state of South Carolina also added an affidavit provision, and then that was cleared under Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act. So we've got these affidavit options seem to be a way in which the courts are willing to entertain a constitutionally permissible way of having a voter identification law. And we have this Wisconsin appeals court at odds with the other courts that are out there at the moment. And so I really do think that this needs to go to the Supreme Court, that we need to get a decision. And I would disagree a little bit that we have a 4-4 split court, because in the Shelby County decision, Justice Kennedy had asked if Section 2 could suffice as a replacement for Section 5. And my feeling is that Kennedy may be willing to join with the four liberal justices, and so there really may be a 5-3 majority on the Supreme Court to uphold this sort of approach that the lower courts, most of them, are taking it, besides this Wisconsin court.
Mm-hmm. And go back to the federal appeals decision being appealed to. What is this panel? Who makes up this panel? Who would
So that would be all of the judges on the circuit would be the ones who would, in an en banc, means everybody together.
Okay. And in terms of, Mark, when all of this has to happen, we're getting pretty darn close to an election. Don't you have to have the rules in place some period of time before everybody votes?
You do, and in prior instances where these cases have worked their way up to the Supreme Court, oftentimes the court, you know, if something has been ordered to change by a lower court in the month preceding the election, the Supreme Court will, you know, put that on hold and freeze it until after the election so that there can be some, you know, certainty as to what procedures will govern the election. Now, these issues are now before the Seventh Circuit, and the parties, the plaintiffs in the cases, have asked the Seventh Circuit, one, for the en banc mechanism that Professor McDonald mentioned, but also to expedite the briefing so that this can be addressed before Wisconsin has to administer its November elections.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's go to Kansas. This has been described as a little bit more complicated. It also had to do with proof of citizenship, didn't it, Professor McDonald?
Yes, and I caution that I can't talk too much about that because the litigation is still ongoing. But yes, the issue at stake in Kansas is that the state has implemented a law which requires registered voters to provide proof that they are U.S. citizens, and the plaintiffs are challenging that on a number of grounds. There's actually more than one lawsuit, just like there is in Wisconsin. The one that I was involved with and know much more about is the whether or not that particular law is consistent with the Motor Voter Law, the National Voter Registration Act of 1993. Motor Voter sets out the documentation that voters need to provide in order to register to vote, and the district court judge there found that the state was in violation of the NVRA, and there's the appeals court upheld that. So as of right now, the state of Kansas has to, at least for federal elections, allow, and for anyone who registers for through the motor voter mechanism through a DMV office, in particular, they are allowed to vote in the federal elections. There's a lot of litigation. There's a lot of moving parts. There's a lot of intrigue with this particular one, and the Secretary of State's office, Kris Kobach, who's the Secretary of State, has been very resistant and has been trying to sneak around court orders. So there's a lot of activity that's still happening in Kansas, and this certainly hasn't been resolved yet, much like these other cases haven't been fully resolved yet either.
Hmm. And then we have Mark, North Dakota, where almost a quarter of Native Americans in the state who otherwise could vote don't have proper IDs. It's true for 12% of non-Native Americans. So this is an interesting state because of the group of people that it appears to be disenfranchising.
Right, and it's important to note that, you know, it's not just African Americans and Latinos that are affected by these laws, but Native Americans as well. And, you know, in some parts of Wisconsin, that could be an issue as well. North Dakota is interesting that this state, you know, historically has not even required people to be registered to vote. So a voter ID law seems inconsistent with, the state's historical openness in its voting laws.
Mm-hmm. And give me, please, a definition, because this is applying to several states, including Wisconsin, this affidavit. How do you get an affidavit? Who vouches for you?
Well, the requirements that Judge Adelman put into effect that have been stayed, it requires that the municipalities running the elections will provide an affidavit, sort of a form that a voter can fill out and check, you know, indicate that they have a reasonable reason why they have been unable to obtain an ID, and then check one of the, you know, sort of preset reasons, which could be family commitments, work commitments, difficulty obtaining the underlying birth certificates or other documentation. And I think one thing that's interesting is that in Texas, the state actually agreed as sort of a settlement on an interim basis to allow this affidavit mechanism, and it's pretty similar in its design to the affidavit that a Wisconsin voter could have, under Judge Adelman's ruling, filled out in the absence of having the voter ID. So, you know, as Professor McDonald noted, it's interesting that, you know, this is almost the exact same affidavit that the states and the municipalities are providing to voters in other states that the Seventh Circuit has now put on hold in Wisconsin.
Mm.
And you know, can I also jump in here? Because it's very important for people to understand that there are actually voter identification requirements that are currently in federal and in state laws across the country. So essentially, the first time you vote under federal law, first register and then vote, you have to provide proof of who you are. But that proof can be just simply a utility statement that has your name and address on it. It doesn't need to be a specific form of photo identification. So when we're being kind of loose here when we're talking about voter identification. What we're talking about are states that are adopting laws that have very specific forms of photo identification that plaintiffs in the cases have said that up to 10% of the population within those states don't have that necessary identification. Mm-hmm. And those people tend to be younger people, they tend to be minorities, they tend to be poor people, they also tend to be elderly people too. And so that's where we really get into the heart of whether or not these particular laws are violations of the Voting Rights Act, because one of those groups are minorities that are being disproportionately affected by the mm-hmm. laws.
In response to what the federal appeals court did, staying this partial injunction on the Wisconsin voter ID law, the governor of our state, Scott Walker, said, and I quote, liberal efforts to stop voter ID were confusing voters. He was praising the decision. Others have said that these have been partisan decisions, that we have judges appointed by Democratic presidents, other judges appointed by Republican presidents, and their decisions reflect a kind of partisanship. Mark?
Well, you know, I'll leave the partisanship point to the commentators. But you know, if you look, it's interesting. If you look at the Seventh Circuit decision, the initial decision by the full court, where they split 5-5 on whether or not to take up full court review of Wisconsin's voter ID law, that was a bipartisan. You know, at least the appointees were bipartisan in which presidents had appointed them, those that were seeking to review the case. So I don't think, you know, judges tend, you know, there's speculation that judges might have partisan interests, but I think that's sort of a dangerous accusation to cast against judges.
Do you agree, Professor McDonald?
It's a mixed bag. I would say most of the judges are ruling not so much from partisanship, but from ideology and their held beliefs. And the people who are appointing them to the courts are appointing like-minded judges when they do so. So that's where the partisanship comes in. It's mm-hmm. more at the selection stage of finding people that you would like to serve as judges, and not so much that these people who are just crassly partisan and writing decisions that are meant to upheld their party.
Well, I wonder if the Supreme Court saw all this coming. Mark?
Well, I think it probably did, and you know, this was sort of the natural consequence of striking down Section 5 was that there was going to be a raft of litigation under Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. And you know, from the perspective of a voting rights litigant, it's unfortunate because it shifts the burden from the states to private litigants and citizens and voting rights groups to, rather than have the states prove to the federal government that they haven't enacted changes or these laws with the intent or effect of disproportionately affecting minorities. Now that shifts that burden in litigation, which can be very expensive, mm-hmm. To private litigants who, you know, might then only bring the most egregious cases forward, because knowing that, you know, the risks with whether you draw a judge that might not be favorable or whether you have a difficult time marshaling the proof, that you know, we might be losing to the crack some of the cases where there are disproportionate effects, but the case might not be quite so cut and dry. So I think the Supreme Court did envision that this would happen, and this is the natural consequence of the Shelby County decision.
Yeah, if I could add to that, two things. One point is that on the issue of whether or not the Supreme Court anticipated this, as I said before, Kennedy asked in the Shelby County oral hearings whether or not Section 2 could replace Section 5 as a mechanism to enforce voting rights. So he clearly had in mind that we would see litigation under Section 2, where before we wouldn't have seen the preclearance process under Section 5 handle many of the cases that would happen across the state as election laws change. The other thing is in Crawford as well, which is the decision that came out of Indiana, which is one of the first states that adopted a photo identification law. The Supreme Court said, in essence, and this is, by the way, Breyer joined with the conservatives on this and said that, well, on face value, identification law could be constitutional, but there could be certain people who might not have the identification. And the plaintiffs in that case weren't really suing on that issue. They were suing about more of the broader constitutionality of having the photo identification law. So they left open the door to something which is called an as-applied challenge, where specific individuals could come forward and say, you know what, I can't get the identification, so therefore the law is impinging upon my constitutional rights. And those are the sorts of cases that we're now seeing emerge out of the courts, are those sort of as-applied challenges to photo identification laws.
All right, we're going to welcome phone calls for both of our guests. We're looking at the court rulings, and there have been a significant number over the past few weeks. Courts ruling against voter ID and also proof of citizenship laws, and then there have been appeals and parts of the laws that were ruled on one way by a lower court were overturned. So it's all fluid, and it's going to stay fluid for a while here as we approach the November 8 election. We have two guests with us, and we'll be entertaining calls for both of them. Professor Michael McDonald, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Florida, and his research interests are in the areas of election and methodology. He's testified as an expert witness in voting rights cases. Mark Gaber is focusing on election law and redistricting in his practice, as well as the First Amendment. He has an active pro bono practice, in particular related to LGBT rights, and we're welcoming calls. Here's how you reach us. If you want to talk about any of those states or talk about photo ID being challenged in many of the states and what the Supreme Court opened floodgates to as a result of their decision in 2013. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Lines are open for you right now. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show. We love to get your comments. And we're on Twitter @KDunnShow. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go to phone calls. We have many voting and how the courts are dealing with voter ID. We go to Dennis in Montello first. Hi, Dennis.
Hi. I'm wondering if when the states decided to look at voter ID, wouldn't the first thing they would look at is the voter fraud data? And how can they decide that, yep, there's a problem after looking at that data if they went ahead and looked at voter like North Carolina did look at the voter practices, wouldn't they look at the data for voter fraud also?
Mark, you want to start?
Well, that's one of the things that the court found lacking in the law. In Wisconsin, the Judge Peterson said, and this is a quote, "The Wisconsin experience demonstrates that a preoccupation with mostly phantom election fraud leads to real incidents of disenfranchisement, which undermines rather than enhances confidence in elections." So I think Professor McDonald has maybe examined this, that the incidences of voter fraud, in-person voter fraud, that these laws are purportedly enacted to prevent, are almost non-existent. Judge Peterson cited one case in his opinion in Wisconsin where one person tried to vote 14 times for Governor Scott Walker, but there wasn't really anything else. So the courts that have looked at this have found this to be sort of a solution in search of a problem.
Professor McDonald?
Absolutely. So, again, we're talking about what fraud could actually be prevented by a photo identification law. And that would be someone showing up at the polling location impersonating another person. Justin Levitt did, who's a law professor at out in California, and he's now working with the Civil Rights Division in the Justice Department, did an examination of all the allegations of impersonation fraud from 2000 to 2014, found 31 allegations, and these were not substantiated, these were just allegations, of vote impersonation out of a billion votes that were cast. So we're talking about something that's a very, very low incidence sort of thing that happens. Not to say that it doesn't happen. It's just that when you weigh what the policy issue that you're trying to solve, which is impersonation fraud versus the harm that you're doing with photo identification laws, the burden is clearly more on those who don't have the identification and less on those trying to stop somehow some fraud, which has extremely low rate of incidence in our elections.
Dennis, thanks for the call. We go to Dan next. Hi, Dan.
Yeah, I think this is more complicated than it needs to be. Why every American gets a free Social Security card, and senior citizens all get Medicare cards. Why can't we just have a law that every single American is entitled to a free photo ID? And then that would take all the cost out of it and everybody would have one.
Professor McDonald.
Absolutely. I agree with you 100% on this. After the 2000 election and the fiasco we had here in Florida, there was a commission that was put together by President Carter and Secretary of State Baker. It's called the Carter-Baker Commission. And they looked at the changes that we might make to our election laws. And one of the recommendations they made was that we should have photo identification if everyone had the identification. And, just to correct just a little bit, you actually have to apply for a Social Security card. So not everybody has a Social Security card. You have to apply for a driver's license. And often you have to, again, have documentation that would support your application, like a birth certificate. In the Kansas litigation, the judge is a military brat. She was born abroad at a military base, and she was a Bush appointee. So again, not to talk about the partisanship, but she ruled in favor of the plaintiffs, and she herself was questioning the state, saying, "I don't even know if I can get my birth certificate because the base that I was born at is now gone." And so these are the problems that some people really face when they are trying to get this necessary identification. And whether we should erect these barriers is one question. But coming back to the original question, yeah, I agree. We should have a national identification card. It would resolve not just the issues of photo identification for voting, but also for application of jobs and help us with our immigration policies and many other things. And at the same time, many of these 10% that I mentioned before that don't have the ID are disadvantaged communities, and having that identification would benefit them greatly when they're applying, say, to have a bank account or cash a check or something of that nature. So there's a lot of good things that could happen if everyone in the country had an identification card.
Mark, do you think we should?
There might be some civil libertarian issues that people could raise. I guess one thing that I would point out that people might not realize about the birth certificates, and Professor McDonald had a good example with the judge, but these can actually be very, very difficult for people to obtain, to get the underlying documentation, to get a driver's license or to get another acceptable form of ID. And the judge in Wisconsin talks about cases of it's disproportionately African Americans and Latinos who were not born in Wisconsin and may have been born in Puerto Rico or in Cook County, Illinois, or Mississippi, where there's sort of endemic problems with the vital record systems, and there might not be records or their names might be spelled wrong on the records. And sort of the hoops and hassles that people have to go through, taking months at times and having to institute court proceedings to get their names changed on their original birth certificate. So it is not an easy venture necessarily for someone to get this documentation. So perhaps a national ID system is something that could fix that, although there would be certainly perhaps even larger scale administrability problems there as well.
Do we have any idea of the number of people who have been disenfranchised or at least temporarily for certain elections because they didn't have photo ID, and we in the states where photo ID has been necessary for some time, do we know how many people just couldn't vote?
What we do know from plaintiffs' experts who have been involved in these cases in various states that, again, approximately 10% of those people who would be eligible to vote don't have the necessary identification, and that number is arrived at by either matching the voter file data with the, say, driver's license and other databases that the states have of different forms of identification that would be permissible, or they do surveys. So we know that that there are people who can't vote because they would lack the necessary identification. What we don't know is how many people actually showed up to try to vote and then were discouraged and decided not to vote. There's some data that we get out of Georgia, who has a state that has a identification law, that we can see thousands of people who have cast provisional ballots lacking the necessary identification. But again, we don't know if there are other people who tried to vote, but then they decided they wouldn't even go through that provisional ballot process in order to complete it, or decided just to stay at home because they don't have the necessary identification. But we can point to Georgia with the hard data there to suggest that at least some people are trying to vote, but then they find out that they can't.
Mm-hmm. Thanks very much for your call, Dan. Let's go to Denise next in Poplar. Hi, Denise.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to know when the states were put in charge of the voter rolls, or maybe they always have. It's just that in the April elections, they said that the books came from the state, and Anacon Township has both addresses in South Range and in Poplar. But the books said that only people from Poplar were residents of Anacon, so the people that were from South Range were told they couldn't vote. And several of without, I think they might have been told they could cast a provisional ballot or fill out additional forms. But several of them, it was late in the day, they just went home.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know enough about the specifics of that case, but in 2002, the federal government passed something called the Help America Vote Act. And one of the provisions in there is that states have to create a statewide database of voter registrations. So prior to the Help America Vote Act, most states, although there were a few that moved in this direction, maintained their voter registrations primarily at the local level. After 2002, states were forced by the federal law to maintain at least a statewide database. Now, how localities interface with that database varies across the states, but we do have that as part of the system of reforms that we had after the 2000 election. And I believe, if I recall correctly, Wisconsin is what we call a bottom-up state, where the localities in Wisconsin are primarily responsible for voter registration, and they provide that data up to the state to compile this statewide database.
Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, this is vaguely in my mind, if you show up at a polling place 5 minutes before the polls are about to close and you find out that you're in the wrong place, that you're in the right city, but you're at the wrong polling place, you can still vote, can't you? Wasn't there some part of some law that made that possible, or am I wrong?
That was also the Help America Vote Act.
I see.
So if you show up and there's some problem with your voter registration record, you can vote a provisional ballot, and then election officials will try to clear up that, and you and yourself try to clear up that issue after you vote. But there are certain states, and North Carolina is a good example of this, they used to allow anybody who showed up at a polling location to have their ballot counted, where they ever showed up within that county. But then they changed the law to say, no, that you had to vote in the correct precinct, that if you cast a provisional ballot in this character and you were in the wrong precinct, then your ballot would not count. And so there's uneven application of how states interpret that and how they implement the provisional ballot requirements across the country.
And that is one of the, I believe that's one of the provisions in North Carolina the Fourth Circuit has struck down as being, you know, enacted with a racially discriminatory intent. The data shows that minorities are more likely to move more often, and so are more likely to be confused as to, you know, what the correct polling place is for them.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for the call. Let's go to Fred in Green Bay. Hi, Fred.
Yeah, good morning. One of the gentlemen that called earlier, part of what I was going to say, photos on Social Security cards. I'm obviously in favor of photo ID. What I don't understand is why can't there just be provisional ballots if somebody doesn't have a photo ID? And maybe in a couple of years, everything will sort of heal itself and people will begin to get their photo IDs. It's just part of a lifestyle, part of being an American. That's just a thought process that I have.
All right, Fred. What about that? We all get provisional IDs if we're unable to get the birth certificate in time.
Well, this is it's sort of similar to what Judge Peterson has ordered in his recent order. Much of the controversy in Wisconsin is about the you know, petitioning process that you go through if you don't have a driver's license, if you don't have one of these other acceptable forms, and you apply for a free ID from the state for voting purposes, but you don't have the birth certificate or you don't have the underlying documentation for whatever reason. Much of the controversy has been about the process that happens at that point. And so as the law has been set up and as the regulations have been put in place in Wisconsin, including emergency regulations issued during the course of the trial, is that you get a receipt that, you know, shows with your picture on it that shows that you're eligible to vote on an interim basis, and that was to expire, I believe, after like 180 days. And the judge said that that was insufficient. In fact, he had a pretty scathing statement about it, calling this petition process, I forget the exact language, but it was that it was just a total facade and that it just was not working. So he's ordered it that he's ordered that this receipt has to be used, this what had been a temporary receipt has to be available on a permanent basis until the documentation can be found by the state to get them a regular voter ID.
Let's welcome more phone calls in just a moment. Thank you very much for yours, Fred. Our number, as we talk about the courts taking on the issue of voter ID, a flurry of court activity over the last couple weeks, one, of course, affecting the state of Wisconsin, two, affecting Wisconsin, and then a state put on one of the elements that had to do with affidavits if you didn't have a voter ID. But all of that, that's going to be appealed now in Wisconsin. And there are cries here for the Supreme Court, probably, to figure all of this out. Five courts in five states have ruled against voter ID and proof of citizenship just in the last few weeks. And our guests are talking about why they have done so and where we go from here on all of this. Professor David, joining us is Professor Michael McDonald and Mark Gaber, and our phone number is 800-486-8655. Michael is an associate professor of political science at the University of Florida and has testified as an expert witness in voting rights cases. Mark is a lawyer. His practice focuses on election law and redistricting, as well as the First Amendment. More phone calls in a moment here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Lori is our next caller in Madison. Hi, Lori.
Hi, Kathleen. You know, I am so distressed. The very fact that we are having this conversation is evidence to me that these laws are having their intended effect, which is really to suppress voter turnout. And also, as I believe it was Judge Peterson in Wisconsin noted, to create the impression among voters that there is voter fraud, or that voter fraud is a question of this type of voter fraud is a question about which we ought to be concerned. It's quite clear from the way that these laws are promulgated that they are intended to suppress the votes of specific constituencies, students, minorities. There are three broad constituencies that have been identified. And, the fact that we're worried about this, 15 years ago, no one would be having this conversation. And this is, we have people who participated in this at the state level. You look at Representative Schultz or State Senator Schultz, et cetera, here within Wisconsin. Sorry, our guests may not know of this individual. Who have described the way that the Wisconsin party has operated, and we have the testimony of individuals that was highly persuasive that shows that the Wisconsin party was deliberately attempting to suppress votes.
Thanks, Laurie, for the call. Professor McDonald.
Well, those are certainly the allegations, and if you look at the appeals court found in North Carolina, the court actually found intentional discrimination was in play in North Carolina. And I do think that we need to restore the Voting Rights Act, restore the provisions of Section 5. Of course, those need to be updated to be compliant with the Shelby County ruling. One way I think the courts could engage in this with absent the gridlock that we already have on this issue within our Congress and our presidency is that the courts could look at there's a particular part of the Voting Rights Act. It's called Section 3, where if a court finds intentional discrimination, the court can tell the state or the locality that, guess what, you get the prize of being under Section 5 again, and it's called bail-in. Mm. And I would hope that when this all goes to the Supreme Court, because that's where it's headed, and it's not just we've been talking about these photo identification laws. There are other cases that have been going up to through the court systems that are finding violations of Section 2. There was one in Michigan about straight ticket voting and the doing away with that particular provision for voters, where a court found that that was a violation of Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. And I could go on. There are many other at the locality level as well. So I would hope that the Supreme Court will look for a judicial remedy here, absent a political remedy from the Congress, to say, look, if you engage in intentional discrimination, we're going to set that bar a little bit lower than where we have in the past and say, guess what, you get to be covered by Section 5 so we can look out for any bad behavior that you may have in the future.
Mm-hmm. Mark, is there any possibility of a political remedy, congressional remedy?
Well, there is an effort in Congress to pass a new version of Section 5 with a new formula, rather a new version of Section 4 that has a new formula and new provisions. Whether that's likely to pass, I mean, at this point, probably unlikely right now. I agree that it's something that is necessary in these cases show that. And, at least one aspect of Wisconsin's law, the in-person absentee ballot restrictions, was found by the court to be passed with discriminatory intent. So, you might be seeing new jurisdictions that weren't previously in Section 4 encompassed. And, I agree that Section 3 is available. The North Carolina court decided not to impose that obligation, but that might be something that we see more litigation about. There's litigation about that in Texas, and with these rulings coming down, not only with the voter ID, but with redistricting that courts are finding to be based on race-based redistricting, that we may see the courts, in the absence of a political solution, impose this on a judicial matter.
Mm-hmm. Laurie, thanks for your call. Let's go to Robert in Green Bay. Hi, Robert.
Hi. I would like just to make a statement that I wish they would just say what the law is, that it's really not anything about fraud and all this. My son is going to go, he's transferring to UW-Stowe for mechanical engineering, but last year he went to UW Marathon County, which is a fancy name for UW-Wausau, and he did all of his homework on how to vote last year, and he actually voted, and he stays in the dorms, Marathon Hall, it's called. That's where he was voting, and he said that he brought his ID. I mean, he has his driver's license. He's got his picture. He gets there, and he hands his ID, and he's in Marathon Hall where he lives, and they said, I'm sorry I can't let you vote today because your address says that you're from Green Bay, but you are in Marathon Hall. Mm-hmm. And he goes, but I live in Marathon Hall. He goes, well, we can't let you vote. And him and about 10 other kids were just like flabbergasted because they brought their driver's license, thought they were following the rules. They all wanted to vote for Bernie Sanders because he somehow got young kids excited for some reason because they look so young, I guess. And then, so what they did was they went to the Marathon Hall to the records keeping and printed out a sheet that proved that he lived there, and then he finally got the vote. My question is, how many kids didn't get the vote?
Right.
And most of these kids, with all that are in the UW system that I've talked to, because of the cuts that they've made, you know, none of them are real big fans of this thing, and some of the cuts, they're not real, you know, like Walker to some of them is like public enemy number one because he keeps, you know, scraping money out of the UW system. So that's what I'm saying.
All
if
right.
they would just go out and say the truth, hey, we're doing it because we want to win. And then that Grossman guy, during when right on the Chris Matthews show, I was watching that, when he said, well, this year Hillary's going to have a lot more trouble because we've got voter ID now and the Democrats aren't going to get so many votes. Oops, slipped. You know, the guy said it flat out.
Thanks, Robert, for the call. College students did have a hard time in this state. There were long lines, I know, here in Milwaukee at Marquette University. I mean, hours long when voter ID was put in place. College students are having a hard time figuring all of this out. Professor McDonald.
Well, you can't escape the fact that the states that have enacted these very restrictive photo identification laws are all states that are controlled by the Republican Party. At the same time, we're seeing the Democratic states move to do things like have, sometimes it's called automatic voter registration or opt-out, where if you go to a DMV office, you're automatically registered unless you say that you don't want to. Or moving to Election Day registration. Colorado just did this. And online voter registration, although there are Republican states who are engaged in that as well. So there is a disparity where the Democratic-controlled states are moving in the direction of being more easing the voting experience, while the Republican states are making voting harder. And that's just a simple fact when you look across the state.
Mm-hmm.
What the intention is, well, I mean, this has been the long history of voting in this country, is that the election laws have always been looked at as a way to manipulate the electorate and change the contours of the electorate to favor one party over the other. And, you know, when we talk about elections, quote unquote, being rigged, that's the sort of rigging that happens in our system. But where elections are not rigged, and I want to be clear about this, is on vote fraud or the impersonation fraud. People are not going around voting multiple times in polling locations. When they do, it's such a rare instance, and it's such a silly way to try and steal election if you stop and think about it, because you would show up and try and vote for somebody else. They may have already voted, and then you're going to be caught immediately, and you have to spend a lot of time going around. So there's no evidence that there's this massive conspiracy to steal elections through that sort of vote fraud. When it does occur, it actually happens in mail balloting, and these photo identification laws largely exclude mail balloting, although Wisconsin is a outlier on that, where you have to provide some identification for mail balloting. But again, we can't really escape that, yes, this is the history of the country, that the election laws set the determination of who's eligible to vote, and that does affect the contours of the electorate.
Mm-hmm. Thank you both so much for being with us. We'll keep an eye on all that's going on between now and November and look at the courts and the states, and thank you for informing us. Thanks, Professor McDonald.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Mark.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks. Professor Michael McDonald, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Florida, and he has testified as an expert witness in voting rights cases, most recently in Kansas. Mark Kaber is a lawyer who focuses on election law and redistricting, as well as the First Amendment. Thanks so much to Scotty Myers for producing this program, and thanks to Kiri Salinas for on-air production here in Milwaukee. Coming up next hour, how hard is it for journalists to be objective, and what does it mean to be objective when you're covering a candidate like Donald Trump? It should be a very interesting hour, and I'll be interested in your comments as well.